WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
My own view of the scientific reassessment and the view of my chair, Dr. David Ozanoff, who was also on this panel, and two others, was that the document was a credible, highly technically sound, up-to-date assessment of the scientific literature about the health effects of dioxin. The Science Advisory Board statements was so different from that that we actually wrote a letter to Science, the journal called Science, saying we disagreed with the statement that had been produced by the Science Advisory Board. And so we were like a minority caucus within the Science Advisory Board panel. So that happened, and that basically when that type of thing happens, the EPA has to go back and redraft the reassessment, the dioxin reassessment, which they did. Took a long time. A lot of new science has been generated in the last 10 years. So there are a lot of things now known about the mechanisms of action of dioxin. There is a threshold for some of these mechanisms. There's no threshold for some others. And some mechanisms, or some toxic effects, are actually supralinear at low dose. So this latest reassessment, which was produced about a year ago, actually says that the sum of the effects, in other words, the supralinear, the linear, and the sublinear effects, cannot be scientifically distinguished from linearity at low dose. In other words, as you increase dose of dioxin, you will increase effects in human beings. And so that was the sort of statement that summarized a lot of the literature in this second draft of the dioxin reassessment. That and other comments like that the dioxin is likely, I think the language is likely to cause cancer in humans. Two other agencies, by the way, simultaneously with this, the International Agency for Research on Cancer has declared the most toxic dioxin, 2378-TCDD, to be a known human carcinogen. They're group one in their classification systems. That happened in 1997, again, by an internationally selected panel that met in France. And so that had happened as backdrop. The EPA's language was quite similar to that in this second draft of the reassessment. And then we went around in November for a two-day public meeting and discussed this new document and new scientific evidence that was summarized in the document. And again, I felt like I was in Gucci Gulch. It was another one of these god-awful hotels. People sitting in the audience were, most of the people were furiously taking notes and, looked like they weren't even going to speak. They were just going to go out and get on their cell phone and call in their notes. And there were people on the panel at both of these meetings who were actually organizing people on the subcommittee who were either consultants to or members of the EPA Science Advisory Board who were organizing sort of private lunches and getting some of these folks from the audience to come and have lunch with them and discuss. So there was a process going on here, folks, and it was very industry dominated. And I could feel it. I mean, I could tell from who was in the room and what was happening and what side conversations were happening that this was going on. And I think this had a very profound impact on yet the second Science Advisory Board summary of the EPA's reassessment. The comments at the public meeting, which are on the public record, they were taped, you can get the transcript off the EPA website, were actually quite, I would say, balanced. And a fair number of people spoke strongly in favor of some of the new EPA comments about dioxin. And for example, the carcinogenicity of dioxin. And it seemed like I felt consensus that, well, it is going to be named a carcinogen, and we should go along with that on the Science Advisory Board. What's happened since is that a document's been drafted by the EPA Science Advisory Board staff that I think has been subverted by industry representatives on the scientific subcommittee. I'll give you one example. Two examples, actually. One is a request by, this is actually made publicly at the November meeting, but is also made separately by email by Dr. John Graham, who I think we'll be talking about some more later, that the EPA should talk about the anti-carcinogenicity of dioxin at low dose. In other words, maybe it protects against dioxin at low dose, and that the EPA's document should reflect that in order to be a balanced document. And he gave two articles from the literature. One was from a rat study by a scientist named Kosiba in the 70s, in which there did seem to be some sort of low-dose decline in carcinogenicity. And a second study that was actually not of cancer, but of altered hepatic foci, altered cells in the liver, again, an animal study that also seemed to show at low dose that there was like a less than linear effect, or maybe even a depressed effect at low dose. Those two studies in the I suppose balancing dozens of studies to the contrary that suggested that it was at least linear, these effects, carcinogenicity and altered liver function or liver foci was at least linear at low dose. And so that process went on after the public meeting. Some of it started in the public meeting. I think the document that the SAB actually produces will have some language like that, but it will say that this is, you know, this is the view of one or several of the members of the committee, not necessarily the majority. I'm getting the hook here from Ken, so I'm going to just mention one other example on the Science Advisory Board briefly. And this is an input by Dennis Paustenbach, who is a toxicologist who works for a company called Exponent, which is, you know, clearly an industry consulting group. He is actually in the Menlo Park, California office. And he's been introducing text to the Science Advisory Board summary of the meetings and new references that we've never seen before and that weren't discussed at these either the public meeting or a public conference call later. And so it forces people like me who want to try to keep to the science and see that this thing is accurate to look up these references. And I looked up a reference that Paustenbach suggested, and it turns out it wasn't what he said it was about at all. It was about something completely different. And it was co-authored by one of his colleagues at Exponent. But it's like an example, I think, of sort of subverting the process. And in that case, it would have been introducing erroneous arguments into a document. And so it's still going on, this draft of the Science Advisory Board reaction to the second EPA dioxin reassessment is nearing final completion. It will go to the agency, and then the agency will decide what, if anything, they're going to do as a result of it. But I'm just here to tell you that there is strong industry pressure on the agency through this mechanism of the Science Advisory Board review of the dioxin reassessment.
Our third panelist, Ms. Laura McCleary, is the panelist who's traveled the first to come here this evening. She is a legal advisor to the president of Public Citizen. She holds a law degree from Stanford Law School, and she is a recent author of a report called Safeguards at Risk, John Graham and the Corporate America Backdoor to the Bush White House. It's a pleasure to have Laura here.
Thank you. Good evening. Public Citizen was invited to participate in this panel because conflicts of interest within the scientific and public policy communities can have serious consequences for the regulatory process. The issues of scientific integrity and governmental integrity are therefore entwined. Industry's efforts to secure scientific credibility for its objectives are a crucial part of the strategy to delay or halt the enactment of protective health, safety, and environmental safeguards. Public Citizen produced the report on John Graham in anticipation of his nomination to the Office of Management and Budget. Our opposition to Professor Graham's nomination occurs in the context of a long-standing debate over the role of economic analysis in the regulatory process. For your background, Public Citizen is a membership-supported 501c3 and C4. We take no money from corporations or government. We do lobbying, litigation, and advocacy research on issues affecting public health and safety. Public Citizen has also consistently opposed what we've termed regulatory rollback efforts. Others have called them regulatory reform efforts. These are sweeping, mostly industry-sponsored attempts to add needless delay and additional steps to the regulatory process, often along the terms of cost-benefit analysis requirements or risk analysis requirements. Professor Graham has consistently sat on the other side of the table alongside representatives from the Auto Manufacturers Association, the Chemical Manufacturers Association, now called the American Chemistry Council. For example, Graham has suggested that cost-benefit analysis supersede federal agency mandates from Congress to protect health, safety, and environmental mandates. And he recently joined alongside members of AEI Brookings Joint Center for Regulatory Studies a brief before the Supreme Court in the Clean Air Act case, which was decided by the court unanimously in an opinion by Professor Scalia, who held that the Clean Air Act did not necessitate a requirement of cost-benefit requirements. OMB review is presently controlled by a standing executive order. A draft of the business community's wish list in this regard has already been written by the Chamber of Commerce and given to the Bush 1 administration, and unsurprisingly includes many pro-industry clauses and specifications. What this means in practice is that Congress would pass a law giving the agencies authority to, for example, regulate the contents of our drinking water. The agency would conduct a full notice and comment process, including a proposed rule, a final rule, any intermediary steps, and probably could perform its own cost-benefit analysis, definitely if warranted by the executive order or by the authorizing statute. At the final hour, the OMB could come in and say the new regulation does not pass muster under its own cost-benefit analysis. Of course, the information used or ignored in the OMB's calculations will determine the outcome of that analysis. At Public Citizen, we simply do not think that economic analysis is up to the task of reprioritizing the government system of safeguards. We also think that a review process that explicitly disregards questions like social justice, consent, and other distributional matters cuts out the heart and soul of what government does. At Public Citizen, we believe that the support for increasing OMB's interference in the regulatory process is perfectly aligned with a particular corporate agenda. As we saw last night, regulated industries will do virtually anything in their power to delay or block potentially costly regulation. Debates over economic principles and risk levels have proved over the years to be a very useful diversionary tactic. Because a majority of the funding for Harvard Center for Risk Analysis derives from the same corporate interests that have supported sweeping regulatory rollback bills, and Professor Graham has consistently testified in favor of these measures, it is hard not to see that this may be a strategic alliance on the part of the corporations. If you are the Chemical Manufacturers Association, for example, your opposition to protective regulation is transparently profit motivated. So it's nice to find intellectual cover if you can. As a way of getting to the heart of the matter as we see it, I want to point out some of the failures of the economic model proposed by Professor Graham and his allies as they are made obvious by well-known political science principles. This is a problem in translation. If you take an economic analysis problem and you translate it to political institutions that are subject to particular incentives, you may have some perversities that come out as part of the process. A commonly known failure of democratic processes focuses upon the injustice of the asymmetry between concentrated corporate interests and diffuse public interests. This is a particularly timely observation this week, given the debate on campaign finance. The problem of wrongful influence on government incentives is heightened in the regulatory setting. Because regulatory costs typically accrue up front and are concentrated as corporate costs or foregone profits. The benefits of protective health, safety, and environmental regulation often accrue over time and are diffusely distributed among many recipients in the public. Benefits may also be what we have called a public citizen self-effacing. Due to their diffuse nature and protective function as cost or suffering avoided, when regulation is successful, it also raises our expectations and our standards of living in ways that we come eventually to take for granted. Data on benefits are typically sparse and are computed where they are available as primarily human fatalities or injuries. But the scope of regulatory action is very broad. It may involve the prevention of diseases for which good information is absent or non-human goals, such as the preservation of ecosystems. Cost information is also suspect because governments frequently rely upon the testimony of the regulated industries in the lack of better data. Industries are notorious for overestimating their compliance costs while a regulation is pending and then magically finding more cost-effective ways of complying once it's actually a requirement. To the extent that industries' incentives are to externalize the costs of their activities in order to enhance profits, comprehensive environmental regulation can also force the appropriate internalization of heretofore unrecognized costs in human and material resources terms, thus creating a more realistic price for goods and services and a more sustainable and accurate economy over the long term. There's the case for the regulatory capture, because all of the above factors are highly manipulable by those arguing in favor or against regulation. Industry interest in OIRA's oversight of the regulatory process will predictably be very strong. And the concentration of considerable power in any one place should be a matter of serious concern for those who are aware that rent-seeking corporate interests could triumph over democratic deliberations and the public good. Ideally, the person who should oversee the regulatory process at OIRA would be an honest broker who would defer to agency scientists and maintain a constant vigilance and concern for the risk of regulatory capture by the regulated industries. Instead, Professor Graham and his allies have consistently supported proposals that would greatly concentrate power within the OMB and add many more tools to an OMB toolbox that is already vulnerable to capture. For example, shortly after soliciting money from Philip Morris, Professor Graham wrote to the White House in 1992 that the White House should establish a group of risk assessors to oversee risk assessments, such as the one that had recently been done by the Environmental Protection Agency on secondhand smoke. In a move that should be of particular concern for public health professionals, Professor Graham has also proposed a sweeping requirement that would impose a near stranglehold on the government's ability to. Professor Graham wrote to the White House in 1992 that the White House should establish a group of risk assessors to oversee risk assessments, such as the one that had recently been done by the Environmental Protection Agency on secondhand smoke. In a move that should be of particular concern for public health professionals, Professor Graham has also proposed a sweeping report peer-reviewed by a panel of non-government scientists, which could include industry-funded scientists, and cleared through the White House once again. These type of red tape burdens would swamp the agency, delay government response to health hazards, and gag the agency's timely announcements on matters critical to public health. Our position is that this demonstrated lack of concern for a predictable and well-known failure in democratic systems, that is, regulatory capture, manifests itself a pro-industry bias. There is also a persistent problem in this work from a moral and political philosophy perspective. Professor Graham would operationalize many highly disputed notions of the monetization of human life and suffering. In other words, lives are compared with dollars and human suffering measured against corporate profits. On an institutional level, there is still another problem. Because the agency's mandates to protect public health, safety, and the environment are the result of efforts by Congress, they represent the culmination of a complex process of moral reasoning. They are, at their best, evidence of a multifaceted intelligence of an ethical government response to social problems, as well as considerable resource-intensive research and scientific inquiry by the agencies. Professor Graham's and others' recommendations to trump this process with the unwarranted expansion of a limited set of economic tools would thus substitute an impoverished and narrow view for a much richer and quintessentially democratic moral and social discourse.
Thank you. Thank you, Laura. Many of us have known Diane Numanowski as a reporter in this city, and several years ago she manifested one of the books that she was a co-author of, which set a new tone for thinking about the role of science in regards to public health issues by introducing us to the whole question of hormonal development issues and also endocrine disruption. Diane has served as a reporter with WGBH-TV, the Boston Phoenix, and the Boston Globe. She was among the pioneers reporting on a new generation of global environmental issues, including ozone depletion, global warming, and the accelerating loss of species, and covered the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio.
Good evening. Our Stolen Future was truly one of the most incredible experiences of my life, and tonight I want to talk about one aspect of it, and that was that it provided the opportunity for me, a person who spent my career as a journalist, to step into a new role and see the world differently. And one of the things that I saw differently when I went from the role of a journalist reporting on these controversies into the thick of a very controversial issue was the realization that there were a lot of things that I was blind to as a journalist, that there are things that I sort of knew were going on, but until I was in the midst of it, I didn't really have a clear view. And one of those things was I was, in general, aware that there was more industry money going into universities. But until I was in the thick of this controversy over our stolen future, and industry really mounted an incredible campaign, I didn't realize the extent to which that had happened without my really noticing it. And as a practicing journalist, I had not routinely been asking people, where is your funding coming from? I had naively assumed that if I called the Harvard School of Public Health, or I called Yale, or Stanford, or one of the rich universities, of course I might have called Duke too, without even, as Shelley showed his slide, I would have assumed that these people were likely getting their money from the National Science Foundation or NIH or whatever. And once I got into the middle of the controversy in Our Stolen Future, I immediately realized that disclosure is a really critical issue. So that's one thing I want to talk about tonight, this degree of industry infiltration. And the other, you know, we've so far been talking a lot about the way that this industry influence might skew the results of science. I think it actually is also playing another really important role that Laura touched on, and that is providing intellectual cover. In the course of doing research on Our Stolen Future, I spent a great deal of time looking back on Silent Spring and Rachel Carson's work, because the work that my co-author Theo Colburn was doing is actually, in scientific terms, a direct successor to Silent Spring. It's not only asking the same questions, but the new science that was synthesized under the umbrella of the endocrine disruption hypothesis is actually explaining many things that Rachel Carson saw and reported, but the science was not there at the time to mechanistically explain why these things were happening. So I was very interested historically in seeing how our book fit with Silent Spring. I was very interested to see that there were actually studies that are key to the endocrine disruption hypothesis that Carson was aware of. There were actually even clues of endocrine disruption, but she somehow just didn't follow that path. She followed the cancer path instead. So historically, it was really interesting. And I was also looking at the way that industry responded after the release of Silent Spring. And if you've seen some of those movies, it's the men versus the women, first of all. There's a real gender attack on Rachel Carson. And there are the men in the white coats denouncing Miss Carson's opinions. And the films are really great if you get a chance to see some of this old footage. And there was a really direct industry attack under the name of industry. These men beating up on this woman, really saying she's just overly emotional and alarmist. And as we saw, as the issue played out, industry lost, or at least it lost in the public arena. There were eventually EPA was established and there were chemical laws passed. I'm not sure that they lost in practice, but they lost in the arena of public opinion. And I think industry became increasingly discredited after Silent Spring and started resorting to other ways of fighting these battles. And the big shift between Silent Spring and Our Stolen Future is that they went underground. So if you look at the news reports, and there was a raft of news coverage following the release of Our Stolen Future, there are very few quotes from industry people or the Chemical Manufacturers Association that now is calling itself the American Chemistry Council, is that right? They keep changing. Every 20 years you recycle your name because you think it, for some reason, there is a way it might play better. But there are very few quotes, and if a reporter was calling the Chemical Manufacturers Association for a quote, the kinds of quotes that it was putting out were things like, well, we think Dr. Colburn has raised some very interesting questions that should be of concern and should be pursued. These completely non-quotable quotes, the opposite of the kinds of attacks that were launched against Rachel Carson. And as this basically controversy went on, and it's more clear to me now, actually, thanks to Laura's report and to other work, Shelley's book also documents that Stephen Safe, who was our leading responsible opposing viewpoint, I guess you'd call him, had received $450,000 of CMA funding for his laboratory. This was never disclosed, and I was making jokes saying they must have cloned Steve Safe before they cloned Dolly the sheep, because there were three of us, and we were doing a lot of media on the book and the issue almost full time. In the months afterwards, I can't tell you how many radio programs I appeared on and TV interviews. And Steve Safe seemed to be everywhere. He couldn't have been doing any science. He was basically there as the voice saying, let's not get alarmed. This is really exaggerated. And through this whole period of time, there was never any disclosure that he was getting chemical industry money for his lab. He was actually, you know, had a very good reputation as a toxicologist on PCBs. So he did not come out of the blue. If you're familiar with the climate change issue, you're probably aware that there are a lot of the naysayers that are also getting money from the energy fossil fuel industry. Most of those people were not people of the status of Stephen Safe, but it's not just on this issue. There are many issues in which the industry is funding naysayers or opposing viewpoints, and this is not disclosed routinely. So I think that for me was a huge revelation, the necessity to always ask where the money is coming from. And similarly, John Graham was a responsible opposing viewpoint, saying that we're all getting alarmed for no good reason. And his connections were not disclosed, and I was actually quite surprised to find from Laura's report the fact that he is affiliated with the American Council for Science and Health, and the lead spokesperson for that group is Elizabeth Whalen. This is another strongly industry-funded group, and Elizabeth Whalen has never seen a chemical she didn't like, and until she may even still be saying that DDT was the greatest gift to humankind that was ever invented, but that's long been her position. There was another group that was all over the web and offering itself as an opposing viewpoint called the Advocates of Sound Science Coalition or something like that. For the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition. John Graham had affiliations with that group. This group's funding was not evident. You couldn't find it on the web. We were trying to find out. There was a lot of activity and people, you know, again, appearing as the responsible opposing viewpoint. And its industry funding was not evident. So I think the overall change since Silent Spring is the fact that industry has created a variety of voices. And basically the battles are being fought. It's almost like a puppet show. You can't see the hands that are behind it. And there are PR firms that are involved in this. You've probably heard about the AstroTurf coalitions of various, you know, groups that are created where you basically create these voices that are meant to sound like a myriad of voices in the public debate when, in fact, the strings all lead back to industry. And that is extremely disturbing in a democracy because it really starts perverting the process in public debate. So that's one of the things I learned when I stepped out of the role of a journalist. I did not realize the extent to which the debate was being manipulated because you're on Daily Deadline and there's this group called the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition. You don't really have the time to track down. And if you're covering climate change, you do not, in most cases, have the time to pursue that. So Ross Gelbspan certainly did a favor for us in his book, The Heat Is On, to follow the money on climate change. And I think it hasn't changed the opinion in the White House, but I think it's certainly diminished the credibility of the skeptics. I guess the other issue I'd like to talk about is beyond this manipulation of the public controversy and the effort to discredit new information, you also have the effort to influence science itself, and we've been talking about that more this evening. Now, there was an incident in the course of the endocrine disruption issue that was very telling, and it really echoes some of the things that we've heard tonight. And that was a visit that was paid to Fred von Saal. He's a researcher at the University of Missouri, and he's been working on the very cutting edge of this low-dose issue. And the big difference between a civil action model of chemical hazards and our stolen future is that when you're talking about this new kind of hazard, you're beginning to talk about hazards at what we consider normal background level. You're not talking about Superfund sites or people whose wells were highly poisoned. You're really talking about the amount of chemicals that a woman carries in her body fat and what that might do to the development of her offspring. So this low-dose issue is incredibly important, and Fred von Saal, industry is scared out of its wits about low-dose. Fred von Saal has been right on the cutting edge, and Dow scientists came to his lab and basically offered him a deal. They said that there would be a mutually beneficial arrangement if he would withdraw a paper that was already in press for a toxicology journal and allow them to replicate and promise not to publish until it had been replicated and he had their permission to publish. So this, you know, this happens. And Fred Vamsal was really insulted by this approach and turned down this deal. And the Let's Make Nice manner of the visiting scientist then turned to this really quite disturbing attack on Fred's credibility and his science. And, you know, Fred essentially showed him the door. And Fred and his colleague, Wade Welshans, wrote a letter to the plastics industry trade group really protesting this approach and putting it on the record, I think, which was of real value. But this kind of thing happens, and there are other researchers who are not as well established as Fred Vamsal, some younger researchers, who are really intimidated by the heat that has been put on them about their low-dose work by the industry. So this is something that is also extremely disturbing. I guess the other two points I'd like to close with is the fact that in my entire career as a journalist, I've had scientists stomp out of talks that I've given when I've suggested that industry funding might be a reason for concern. And I can say that from my personal experience as a journalist, I've only seen one pair of researchers publicly and urgently bite the hand that feeds them. And these were acid rain researchers from the University of Vermont who were receiving utility funding. They found really disturbing effects on Camel's Hump, which is one of the mountains that is still really badly under assault from acid rain. They went public. They did an article in Natural History. They gave interviews, and they never got a dime of utility money again. So I think that's what happens when you bite the hand that feeds you.
Now move on to our fifth speaker, who is Dr. David Wegman, who is professor and chair of work environment at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He received his MD and Master of Science degree from Harvard. Dr. Wegman has focused his research on epidemiological studies of occupational respiratory disease, musculoskeletal disorders, and cancer, and has published over 200 articles in the scientific literature.
Thank you, Ken. I want to turn a little bit now to a somewhat more subtle area. What happens when this money comes into the university that's industry-sponsored? Here's the problem. Scientific research involves the discovery of new knowledge. Industry sponsors environmental and occupational health research in specific primarily to protect its economic interests. So why would a university accept industrial funding if it's to protect economic interests of the industry? Presumably because it can write the rules and provide adequate protection for its investigators. And I think many science investigators in the universities are comforted by the protections offered by the offices of grants and contracts and the contract rules that protect rights to publish. But I want to ask some questions about how good this protection is in a more subtle way. The common feature of environmental and occupational health research contracts is an industrial advisory group, a group that is identified not to be a group with veto power over the product, over the publications, but one that is simply to provide advice and to, particularly around technological issues, and to make certain that all the information that's collected is correctly represents what is truth in the outside industrial settings. And they are to be advisors but not controllers. How does that work? Can these panels work as advisory panels and not influence the research? I want to give you a couple of examples where I think the question has to be answered no. As a young faculty member here at the Harvard School of Public Health, I was funded to investigate a condition that was newly identified in clinical case reports called meat wrapper's asthma. The leading hypothesis in the literature was the source of the asthma was the hot wire cutting instrument that was used to cut plastic wrap in supermarkets that was then used to wrap meat products. Industry sponsored a research project to carry out this investigation. And there was this industrial advisory panel that accompanied the research. Now, this panel did not deny the leading hypothesis, and this panel did not force me not to investigate that leading hypothesis. What this panel did do was constantly raise alternative hypotheses of what could be investigated, even to the point of suggesting that maybe the problem was the bone dust from the meat that was cut and that was then generated in these environments before the food was wrapped. The problem that we faced as investigators was the difficulty in saying to the industrial science advisory group, this is not possible. We refuse to do this part of the investigation. We're going to stay focused on our part of the investigation. And so we covered the waterfront. We've dealt with all of their issues, and we also dealt with our own issues. And we came out with some results, which ultimately did lead to some change in the way the industry did the cutting of meat wrap. The point I'm trying to make about this is that we spent an awful lot of time doing research that, had we been asked to set our own priorities and use our own wisdom and our own advisors as to how we would prioritize which to investigate and which to decide not to investigate, we would have done a much different type of research and much more work in the area which we had to, in a sense, cheat on because we were spending time following what I believe were blind alleys, although not impossible, not implausible. Another example occurred to a colleague of mine who was involved in exposure assessment for a study of cancer risk with fiber exposures. And in the course of her research, the contract called for a established methodology to estimate exposures from job histories in a work environment and do an exposure response study to find out whether there was cancer risk associated with these fibers. And in the course of her investigation, she developed a new hypothesis as to how people should potentially come up with a better measure of exposure. And it was something that she hypothesized. She wanted to see if it was tested against the established method, whether it showed any improvement at all. She was willing to accept the possibility that it did not. She has not to date been allowed to use or have that hypothesis used because the industry says that's not what they bought. They bought the established methodology. The advisory panel said they didn't want to follow this investigation. Well, it's true. What the university bought was a research proposal which had an established methodology in it. On the other hand, what is research about? New knowledge and new hypotheses, and this one is another example of a frozen hypothesis. Can industry sponsor research outside the university and have that research be independent? Yes, I'm sure there are some good examples of this, but I have a couple of examples of problems associated with that. Primarily, research serves the economic interests of the private sector. So the research that's going to be funded, particularly private sector research, even if it's independent investigators, is going to be funded to support an economic interest. An example, in a sense, of a positive one of these was given by a colleague who reported that Barry Commoner was approached in the late 1970s when the new plastic bottle manufactured from PET plastic was being introduced into commercial use. Shortly after its introduction, questions were raised about the validity of some toxicology tests that had been done and whether this was really a safe product. And Barry Commoner was approached by the glass bottle manufacturing companies with a very legitimate, economically interesting question. Is this stuff toxic? The reason they wanted to know was, if it was toxic, they were darn well going to stay in glass bottle manufacturing. And if it wasn't toxic, they saw the writing on the wall, and they were going to move into plastic bottle manufacturing. So they wanted the true answer, and they didn't have a vested interest one way or the other. So in that setting, the research might have been carried out without undue influence from industry. The other example I want to go to is an old and tried, almost hackneyed example of benzene. And the initial studies of occupational cancer and benzene that really put it on the map were the studies that Infanti and colleagues published in 1977 suggesting a very high excess risk of benzene and leukemia risk in workers in an Ohio plant. This a consultant to the American Petroleum Institute at one point back in the 70s told me that benzene is a cottage industry. There's more research done around this study than most other topics, let alone most other substances. This particular study was criticized at the time by industry consultants by saying that additional information was showed that the estimates of exposure were incorrect, that they were too high, too low, that the high, exposures really were higher and therefore the dose response was lower. Infante reported in his response to that that he'd asked for that information. Somehow it hadn't been previously available. Now the additional information was available. In 1987, Rinsky updated that report and re-established the risk with essentially the same level of risk. He was now able to show a dose-response relationship that was very nicely modeled, and he had a much more elaborate exposure assessment that was carried out. In 1992, another exposure assessment was done, sponsored by the industry, and my understanding is it cost about $1 million to go back in to get more additional data that was newly found from these same records on this same population. And a new exposure assessment was done, which then was applied to a risk assessment. And I just, perusing Medline today, found that in 1998, the Japanese Society for Occupational Health used that exposure assessment in setting their proposed occupational exposure limit for benzene. So is that bad? Was that last exposure assessment a poorer exposure assessment or a better exposure assessment? I don't know. It certainly had more detailed information in it. But what I'm particularly upset about is that none of this money goes into looking for more detailed exposure information in negative studies. It's only if it's a positive study out there that suddenly there's a massive effort that you go into to try to find new information. So you might have good science being done, but is it unbiased science? I would say no. Well, where do we stand now? Shelley illustrated quite dramatically the increase in industrial funding that's going into the university setting today. Some of you may be puzzled by that. NIH seems to keep getting, you know, $10, $15 billion more every year, so there should be more money out there in the public sector. Well, certainly in the area of occupational and environmental health and toxicology research, not a lot of money is going that way to solve problems in our modern industrial environment. So what can we do to address these problems? First, I think we need to establish some mechanisms to protect the independence of investigators. We have to design mechanisms to protect researcher independence regarding the conduct of the study, the use of the data, and the public dissemination and publication of the data. Stronger protections than currently exist within the university grants and contracts environment. We have to appropriately limit scientific advisory boards regarding their independence from the sponsor or the sponsor's independence from them, their role during the study, their appropriate role, and the role of interpretation and determination of results. And finally, worker rights and notification need to be included so that workers learn about this information, not just from JAMA, as was suggested last night, but by efforts to notify and disseminate the findings to the workforce. Lastly, we need to establish a firewall between the sponsor and the research scientist. And such firewalls are possible. They are used in Europe. Our example, a sad one to my mind, is the Health Effects Institute, because they have a wonderful co-sponsorship of industry and EPA in funding a lot of good research, but they're also subject to the same kind of pressures that industrial funding puts elsewhere. One of my colleagues was funded to study asbestos in commercial buildings, started the study under HEI sponsorship with 50% industry funding, and 6 months into the study, the money was pulled because the industry didn't like who was doing the studies. Thank you.
Our last speaker on the panel is Dr. Richard Levins. Dr. Levins has long been a mentor and teacher for many of us. I also have been one of the people who was affected in my early training at reading material and listening to him speak. It's interesting that he started out as a tropical farmer and labor organizer turned ecologist, and he's worked in agriculture and public health ecology and science development. He teaches human ecology here at the Harvard School of Public Health.
You already know about the tobacco business. You've heard about Firestone Brimstone and suppressing information about the dangers of their tires. You've heard about asbestos and their defense of asbestos in the lung. You've heard about Ralph Nader's struggles about automobile safety and the denials by the agricultural chemical industry that their products would be potentially harmful. So I'd like to take a step backward, squint, and welcome you to the world of the KMOs, the knowledge marketing organizations, where science is increasingly and increasingly directly a commodity. Now, it seems obvious and not a very profound thing to say, but that has important consequences, because a commodity is something which is produced for the purpose of making money by marketing it. And this could be done in a number of ways. Some of it is done directly in industry to develop and defend their own products. Some of it is carried out in government departments and then licensed to industry. Some of it through grants to universities. Scientific publishing is increasingly in the hands of a small number of private publishers. And some of these produce journals, like one of the Elsevier journals, which has a subscription price of about $1,200 a year. So it's clearly aimed at a small group of industries rather than at the scientific community. Educational publishing at present is controlled by about four major conglomerates. Universities are actively seeking closer and more intimate ties with business. I recently saw on the web something about a BU department, Boston University, where they talked about the links of their programs to other universities. There are about half a dozen there. And then a long list of industries that they're linked with, particular corporations. So now, why is this happening? It's basically the Willie Sutton phenomenon. The bank robber, Willie Sutton, explained that he robbed banks because that was where the money is. So as funding from public sources become more and more difficult, there's a greater and greater pressure to go to private industry and to accept the dangers. Now, the universities have done a lot of thinking about how to avoid this danger, about how to maintain the objectivity of science. I think, however, that they've done it in a too narrow way. The big problem is not the relationship of a particular researcher with a particular company, but of the research community as a whole with the corporate world. The corporate world begins to set the agendas. After all, they're going to hire the graduates, so we have to train them to do the work for the agenda that the corporations have. Now, not all knowledge is equally turnable into marketable commodities. If there's a disease, let's say the late blight of tomatoes, well, let's invent a fungicide that we could sell to farmers every year. Monsanto is not going to provide funding for a program which says, plant beans under your tomatoes, and that'll interrupt the splashing of spores from the rain onto the tomatoes' leaves. So what happens then is that we develop a pattern of knowledge and ignorance in our education, in our scientific journals, and it looks as if this is dictated by nature, so that when the chemical industry praises their achievements, they compare using their products to doing nothing at all, rather than examining the world of alternatives. Now, a commodity is made for profit, but this means that something is not profitable, it will not be made. And this gives you the pattern of under and over development of research. The search for molecules becomes the paradigm for understanding the world, and we have the current obsession with the Genome Project, which is really a continuation of Linnaeus's 18th century project of describing what is it that we have, rather than getting into the questions of how things work and how do they interact. It seems to be more profitable to examine, let's see if we can find a gene for cirrhosis, instead of tracing the relationship between a recession, unemployment, depression, and alcohol consumption. A second consequence of the commodity form of science is competition, the hiding of proprietary information in order to patent in a hurry. Therefore, the reluctance of scientists to share information, either because they're worrying about getting the patent or because the terms of their grant prevent them from doing so. So science is no longer public knowledge. Third, it leads to a whole strategy of protecting a commodity from criticism. Law firms, legislative lobbying, hired science, research sponsorship, sponsoring of candidates for public office, all of this contributes to protecting commodities from criticism. Not forever, but simply delaying, because part of the cost-benefit of analysis in industry is to figure How long can we delay the removal of this product from the market until it becomes too costly because of litigation? Next, there's the infiltration into universities where industry is trying to train its own employees, its labor force of the future. So we're not training broad scientists anymore who can look at the whole of living nature. We're not asking the question, what might be the best way of reducing the prevalence of cancer, but rather, what drug might we be able to invent in order to treat patients with cancer? So we have the rush to patent first means exaggerating claims about the beneficial effects of something and belittling any acknowledgement of potential harm, hiding, denying, getting lawyers to duck liability, and so forth. The diverse impact on intellectual content of science is also there less visibly. For instance, suppose we did a study which showed that our best guess is that a particular compound increases the danger of cancer by 50%. But there's a margin of error. It's also possible that it has no effect at all or that it triples the risk of cancer. This would be interpreted as saying the null hypothesis that there is no effect is compatible with the data and then would be translated into the press saying scientists have found that the chemical is harmless. So we have traditions of statistical analysis, perfectly legitimate within the history of statistics, that work in a biased way, which makes the threat to profit more important than the threat to people. This leads then also to a fractionization, a fragmentation of scientific knowledge within specializations, within which scientists would resent the invasion of anybody from outside their discipline, and they in turn would be afraid of stepping on anybody else's toes. So we don't see the whole, and we have a pattern of increasing rationality in the small at the level of the laboratory bench, along with increased irrationality at the level of the scientific enterprise as a whole. And this is not a matter of particularly sleazy lawyers or public relations experts conspiring to kill children, but simply sound business practice. So the conflict of interest is not between the individual scientist and the corporate and the particular corporation, but between science and the corporate world. So what we can do about it? First of all, I think we need publicly funded, stable research support that is not accessible to the pressures of industry or government agencies influenced by industry. Next, I would think that we need a frank partisanship. We recognize that we are not neutral, that our concern in public health is protecting people, whereas our adversaries always describe it in terms of feeding the hungry or protecting their workers or something else benevolent. And I've never heard an industry spokesman say, no, this regulation is bad because it would reduce the dividends that we give to our shareholders. Next, we need a democratization of science in several different ways. In the recruitment of science, every time the doors of science have been opened to a new segment previously excluded, the science has been transformed. Primatology and animal behavior was transformed by the admission of women. Sickle cell anemia became a medical issue as against an anthropological curiosity when the Black Panther Party started visiting the biology department at the University of Chicago. Thanks. Next, the linking of professional and non-professional inputs to science. There's an awful lot of knowledge out there in people's experience, and some of the best occupational research has been done by a collaboration of the union representing workers in an industry with scientists, where there's a combination of the detailed, intimate knowledge that people have of their circumstances and the general scientific and comparative knowledge that requires a certain distance. We need a broadening of the scope of science from the increasingly narrow fragmentation to transdisciplinary work that makes a problem big enough so that an answer will fit, instead of reducing the problem smaller and smaller to finish the work within the terms of a grant. And we need the active participation of labor in determining the conditions of their own work, in influencing the choices that are made in what is produced, how it is produced, and what protection is necessary. So the conflict of interest between science and the corporate world requires a restructuring about the way we think of our own activity. And this requires science to be as reflective of its own history and the influences on it as we would require in any other field. understanding that the agenda of science is not dictated by nature, but by the structure of the knowledge industry. And in that way, we can make choices. Is their agenda really our agenda? What are the questions that ought to be asked instead of the questions that are being asked? What are the alternatives to the present fashions? And in that way, then, I think that we could have a science which really does serve the community.
You've been listening to a panel, Who Owns Science?, held at the Harvard School of Public Health last March. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio in Boston for this tape. And again, the Seneca County Legislature is meeting next Tuesday at 8 p.m. at the County Building in Waterloo, located off Route 414 just north of the 520. They will consider a resolution opposing the drilling for oil and gas in the Finger Lakes National Forest. Please come to the meeting and make your voices heard.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.